Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a time with air travel, fast warships that can span the globe, and instantaneous global communications, a country's geography may seem to be a relic from the last century in terms of strategic and geopolitical viewpoints. But my guest today says geography, the makeup of the land, natural resources, the demographics, and climate, may play as large a role in a country's foreign relations as the political leadership. Tim Marshall first made this case in his bestseller, Prisoners of Geography, which examined the world's great and emerging powers. He now follows that up with his latest book, The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World. In it, he looks at Australia, a key outpost in containing China, Iran and Saudi Arabia, two countries with competing and antagonistic governments and religious sects who control much of the world's petroleum supplies, the UK and Spain, European countries that are less European than meet the eye and are fraught with ethnic groups clamoring for autonomy, Greece and Turkey, antagonists back to antiquity, now with new offshore gas deposits in Greek waters just off the Turkish coast, and a Turkic nation wishing to reclaim influence and empire, the Sahel and Ethiopia, where competition for natural resources, heavy metals in the Sahel, and water could be trigger points, and finally, space itself. Tim Marshall was a longtime foreign correspondent and diplomatic editor for the UK's Sky News, as well as the BBC, with 30 years reporting experience. He's a founder and editor of the whatandthewhy.com, a current affairs website, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tim Marshall, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's nice to be in Oklahoma, if only on the airwaves.
So much of the explanation of the tensions inherent in the areas you describe in The Power of Geography come down to demographics, the large-scale geography. And I just kept thinking, as I read through the book, you know, American education has downplayed geography for, you know, my education 40 years ago was not stellar, and my children's education 20 years later was, you know, even less so. You know, we view geopolitics through the lens of leaders and political parties. How much should we attribute a nation's action to the geography?
A great deal, but not in its entirety, because then you'd only be a determinist, you know, and there would be no choices. There are some, but they are limited because of geography. I mean, look, leaders do count. You know, they make decisions pulling you in and out of alliances or whatever, but a much deeper structural push factor is geography. I mean, look, your own country is built on this. You are the only country that can project power into two oceans simultaneously. Teddy Roosevelt demonstrated it. And, for example, the moment you guys did the Louisiana Purchase and the Mississippi River Basin that came within it and the farmland and the rivers, you're made. So, you know, those sorts of things are not difficult concepts to get, and I wish they were taught more.
Is that an issue you see around the world, that people don't learn about the geography? And I'm talking about the large-scale geography, not just, you know, the rivers, the mountains, but the demographics, yeah, the mineral wealth, all the things that make up the large-scale geography.
Yes, and I mean, you know, obviously geographers teach this stuff, and the macro stuff, I think, is so easy to get across, and the concepts of what the macro stuff means. But what I do find is that in the news media, when they're looking at country X or conflict Y, they don't frame it within the geographic context. I'll give you an example. I was covering the Syrian war a few years ago, and at one point there was this narrative that the government forces of Assad had lost half of the country. And geographically speaking, they had, but the point I tried to make was they've lost half of the sand. Because when you looked at the country, there's only one motorway in Syria. And I looked at all the different cities, the backbone of the country, and nearly all of it, like 85% of the population, was still under government control. So, you know, you need that sort of geographic framing if you really want to understand what's going on somewhere.
Did that give forces that were somewhat opposed to the Assad regime maybe a false belief that the regime was more unstable than it truly was?
No, I don't, because they would know their own country and their own territory, and they knew that what they needed was the power bases. You know, they need the concrete. This is a point I keep saying. You know, look at where the concrete is, and that's true of America. I sometimes say, if you want to, you know, here's a map of America, and I put up a map of the world, obviously with America, you know, front and center in it, but then I also put on all the places you have concrete. You know, you have concrete in Bahrain, in the Sea of Japan, in the Bay of Naples. That's the real American map. And so the people there would have figured what was going on. But my issue was with the wrong narrative being given, that because you lose 50% of the territory, you know, you've actually lost 50% of the country. And this is where geography comes in, you know. And I learned this very early on in the Bosnian War, which, you know, is almost ancient history now for some people. But I learned in the Bosnian War to really concentrate on terrain, which roads connect to where, because suddenly everything is open for you to understand, that's why they're doing this.
Hmm. Now, this book, The Power of Geography, is it in some way a companion to The Prisoners of Geography, which I think it covered the major powers, China, U.S., Russia, you know, the obvious hotspots, Koreas and things like that.
Yeah.
And so what sort of guide did you want to take with these areas of the world that you cover in this particular book?
Yeah, I like that word. Thanks, Rick. Companion, because, I mean, you can read them completely separately, but they do complement each other insofar as I have gone down to more second-tier nations. But it's interesting how they fall into place in their relationship sometimes with the bigger nations. I mean, Australia is a very good example of this. One of the themes running through the new book, Power, is it's not explicit, but I believe we're heading back towards a form of Cold War, small c Cold War, because, you know, nothing is ever quite the same. And in that form of bipolar world, countries are going to have to make choices. And I'm arguing that Australia's already made its choice because it's clearly sided for the rest of the century with the Americans. You know, they could have hedged their bets. They could have tried to cozy up to the Chinese because the Chinese are really bullying them. But no, they have clearly made their choice. So the British have made their choice. I think Turkey is an example of a country, and this is why there are chapters on Britain and Turkey, and Greece and Australia. They're hedging their bets. They're thinking, I'm not under enough pressure yet. I'm still going to play in this interim period of, you know, from the former Cold War bipolar world, in this interim period of the multipolar world, they can still afford to play. So that's one of the themes. And, you know, Iran is another chapter that they have also been busy playing while you guys have had your eye off the ball in Afghanistan and Iraq. But now, post-Afghanistan, you're back concentrating on the bigger issues that really do concern, you know, the biggest, most powerful country in the world. And that is that you're now going to focus again what you would have focused on 20 years ago, Russia and China.
Now, let me ask you about that idea that we will go back to a bipolar world. Do you really believe that as opposed to a multipolar world, which sees the United States step back, which we do have this tendency, and especially right now after Afghanistan, the pullout of Afghanistan, I think we're not looking for any more foreign adventures. And a lot of people believe this creates a vacuum in which there'll be, you know, multiple regional powers competing along with the world powers.
I completely understand that argument. I am confident, and most of us are guessing, let's be fair, and we're all guessing when it comes to the future. But I am confident that the conclusion drawn in Moscow and Beijing is not that this is it for the Americans, it's all over for them. Because people said that after Saigon, and it wasn't true. And they're saying it again after Afghanistan, and I don't believe it's true now. Because I just think there are these much bigger issues, partially based on geography, and the conclusion drawn in Moscow and Beijing is that you will now concentrate. You know, you completely had your attention elsewhere, and there is only so much bandwidth. But your bandwidth will now be focused on those two places. And when, I mean, I have to keep returning to geography. I mean, I can tell that you and I could talk about all sorts of stuff for longer than we have. But look at the map. Look at China and America. Look what separates them. Then look at the incredible interests of America in keeping the international sea lanes open. And they're the only navy which really at the moment can do that. America cannot allow a number of things to happen. Firstly, they cannot allow the international sea lanes in the South China Sea to come under Chinese complete dominance. In other words, they cannot accept China's claim that it controls and owns the whole of the South China Sea. So it must stick by its allies, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, to an extent Taiwan. Because if it fails them, all of those people, again, look at the map and look how close they are to China. At the moment, they are pushing back against China, but they will not push back if America is seen not to be with them pushing back. And so it's kind of built into the geography. And now, here you do have a choice. Mm-hmm. If you want to cede that, if you want to cede half the Pacific to China, back off. And that is a rational move you can make. But what will flow from it is that the Philippines will think, I'm not going to stand up to China anymore. And South Korea is going to wonder, you know, what to do next. So, you know, there's an awful lot of flow, things that flow. I mean, look, it's not as simple as this, and you know that. But when you look at that map and then you look at grand strategy, it really helps to put things into context.
My guest today is Tim Marshall, a foreign correspondent and a diplomatic editor at Sky News in the UK for many years. He's the author of the bestseller Prisoners of Geography. And his latest book is The Power of Geography, 10 Maps that Reveal the Future of Our World. It's published by Scribner, and it focuses on Australia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, Greece, Turkey, the Sahel, Ethiopia, Spain, and space as a new frontier of conflict and perhaps cooperation, perhaps conflict. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you mentioned earlier, you begin with Australia, and this is a continent nation that until a month ago, I think very few people who don't follow this closely would say, oh, this is a geopolitical center for potential conflict. And then, of course, came the squabble over the nuclear submarine sales to Australia, and all of a sudden people are saying, Australia needs nuclear submarines? Australia looks to be a major sort of, if not confrontation point, at least a competition point between this competition between United States and China.
Yep. And as I said, it's made its bet. And this comes back to geography. You know your history. 1941, Japan had invaded what is now Papua New Guinea. It was about to invade Australia. It had bombed the city of Darwin. Up until that point, this huge continent, which can't grow a big population and a big navy because of the geography of it, always looked to the British and the Royal Navy to come and make sure it was protected. Well, the British were very busy at the time, and the Australians knew they couldn't rely on the British. Who could they call? They called the States, and the States showed up, and they've been with them ever since. Okay, now it's 2021. It's not Japan anymore that's considered a threat, but it is China. And the Australians know that if China comes down what's called the first island chain and into the islands closer to them, they will dominate them. I'm not making a case for or against, you know, and the rights and wrongs. I don't really bother myself with all that. I just know it. That's what will happen. They're already buying ports in Papua New Guinea. They're already putting their spy ships down in the tiny islands in the Pacific. So Australia has a choice. And they fell out with the Chinese. The Chinese have economically bullied them. And China has turned again to America. The submarine deal. They're not buying nuclear-armed submarines. That would be a bit too much for China and others and some of the Australian population. Now, the reason they're getting nuclear-powered submarines and they've ditched the French diesel submarines is that diesel submarines, A, can't stay underwater for as long, and B, are a lot noisier. The Australians have read the future. They know the British are in with the Americans. The British sailed their aircraft carrier down to the South China Sea with the Americans this summer. And they know that the three of them together are better off in this ability to contain China inside the first island chain. And that's what it's all about. And it's about an even bigger issue than that, Rich. It's about Biden's idea that the architecture of the 21st century is that the industrialized democracies stick together. And by that, I mean Japan and India and South Korea as well, with the three nations I've just mentioned and others, to contain the authoritarian states. You know, that's as macro as I can get.
Well, as you point out, in Australia's case, you know, it has enormous coastlines. It can never have a Navy large enough to patrol it. It has made it the decision that the United States is going to be that partner.
Exactly. And, you know, it is based on geography. They're not completely boxed in. They could have made the choice. We don't trust the Americans. We think China will be the power that we need to partner with, and we're going to cozy up to them. But they haven't made that choice. My first book was Prisoners of Geography. I mean, it's a good, strong title, and I would argue you can make the argument that it is a prison. But, my get-out clause is that you can bend those bars a little, and technology can bend those bars, and you do have agency of choice. But, you know, there are limits, as the Swiss Navy knows.
In the next section, you look at Saudi Arabia, and you have a very interesting take on IBS, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. You know, he's sort of considered a persona non grata in many cases because of his alleged role in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. But you also say he's trying to walk this very thin line in trying to modernize Saudi Arabia, reform the relationship between Wahhabism and the Saudi royal family and the leadership of the country. And at the same time, he kind of sees the writing on the wall when it comes to petroleum. Yes, petroleum is important now. It's going to be important for the near future, but maybe in a generation or two, it may not be as important. And of course, that importance of petroleum is why Saudi Arabia matters in world geopolitics and why it matters to the United States, most importantly, as its protector.
Very much so. And, you know, it begs the question, if they're not important anymore, why would America fight for Saudi Arabia's solar panels? It wouldn't. So they've drawn that conclusion, and they realize they're going to have to diversify and change. On the first point, that's more, you know, I think a lot of people find this more problematic, but it's too easy just to say that Saudi Arabia should reform immediately, that, you know, all the rights that women have in other countries should immediately be introduced. Now, that's what you might want, but sometimes be careful of what you want. I mean, of course, that, from my perspective, and I assume yours and your listeners, would be the right thing to do. But it wouldn't be the right thing to do if it only lasted one day. And then the Wahhabis, because, you know, there are two pillars holding up the House of Saud. One is the Wahhabi tribe, and the other is the House of Saud tribe, you know, because not all of Saudi Arabia is made up from these two tribes. Now, if the Wahhabis, who are the really hardcore religious pillar of the country, felt that they were strong enough that they could turn this round on day two, they would. And so if you move too fast, you risk the whole thing. There is an example. The Saudis introduced TV, I think, in the 60s, and the Wahhabis were outraged. It resulted in the murder of the leaders. And the response was not to have more liberalism. The response was to have more oppression, to get rid of women on television, so if you move too fast, you do risk losing everything. It's a hard argument to make because you're essentially saying, no, you shouldn't have this yet. But I think you should have it, but whether you could have it is a different argument.
Talk about the future of petroleum. Is Saudi Arabia looking towards a future in which petroleum plays a far lesser role in its underpinning of the country itself?
Yes. And this is where Crown Prince is forward-looking. Yeah, I held no candle for the Crown Prince. You know, I'm well aware of the American government's report into what happened with the murder of the journalist in the Turkish consulate. And I'm well aware of, you know, all the many shortcomings. But that's not really the point. The point is that he has worked out that over a period of decades, Saudi Arabia is not going to be able to, what's it going to be able to sell? If nobody wants to buy their oil, what are they going to sell? They're not going to sell their sand, so they need something else. So he is very slowly diversifying the workforce and allowing women into it. Women need to be able to drive to work, and so he's trying to relax some of those rules. He's encouraging tourism. He's encouraging renewable energy, big time, because he's read the future. He knows that the world will withdraw from Saudi Arabia, and it certainly won't fight for it. And when they discovered the stuff they have to sell, there were 2 million of them. Well, there's about 25 million of them now. How on earth are you going to pay for their standard of living if nobody's buying what you've got? And he's read that future, and he is being proactive. I don't know if they can pull it off, but I do know that at least they've had the wisdom to begin early and start trying.
I want to ask about two countries that you profile that I've heard this argument for about 20 to 30 years that they're European countries. I'm speaking to the United Kingdom and Spain. And I've heard these arguments that, you know, there are these, Scotland, for example, when it comes to the UK, Catalonia, and the Basque country in Spain. And, you know, every European country has that minority that to a degree wants a little more autonomy to, you know, to the perhaps the outlier idea of independence. How serious is that to countries like Great Britain, the United Kingdom, and Spain?
Well, those two, Britain and Spain, I think it's a genuine threat. And I think it's a bigger threat in the UK, Britain, than it is in Spain. I think they can manage the Catalonian situation, although, I mean, you know, you see how much it got out of hand 3 or 4 years ago. You know, the leaders were jailed, there was riots in the streets, and it hasn't gone away. When it comes to the UK, there's this huge split, and it really has divided our country, which is Brexit. And we've left the European Union, but overwhelmingly in Scotland, people voted to stay. But, you know, they are part of the four nations that make up the UK. So just because the majority of one of our nations, you know, it doesn't mean that they can stay in the EU. In order to join the EU, although I think it would be a hard ask, they have to leave the UK, you know, different union. That's why this has come back, because the Scottish independence movement, it won the right to have a referendum a few years ago, but it lost it. A small majority of Scottish people said, no, we want to stay British within the UK. But Brexit has brought that back to the front burner, and I think there will be, in this decade, another referendum. And here's the last bit of this argument. If Britain messes up Brexit big time, and, you know, our economy, standard of living, all the rest of it, decreases sharply across the decade, I think there's a good chance that that argument this time would be won by the separatists. If Brexit is made a success, then they probably would vote to remain. And this Brexit battle, it just goes through every single thing that's going on in British politics. I mean, we're having a row with the French about fish. It's not really about fish. It's about whether Britain can make a success of its economy, because the French are adamant that we must be seen not to make a success of it. Because if we do, what's to stop other countries leaving the European Union? You know, it just runs through so much. You know, we're still fighting the Brexit war, 4 years after we voted to go?
Yeah. And I was interested in your explanation of how geography had an influence on the decision for Brexit. Can you maybe talk about the geography influence that sort of keeps Britain, if you will, at arm's length from Europe? It was never a great EU member. It was always looking for exemptions. Didn't want to necessarily do everything like the it didn't adopt the currency. Is there a geographic influence on that?
I'm certain it is, but I'm not sure you can prove it. I think it's one of those things that's not quantifiable. But you know, you're absolutely right. We've always been this semi-detached member of the EU throughout the 4 decades we were in it, and some of our intellectual class would push back against this. But I make arguments not because I want them to be right or wrong, it's because this is what I believe. But I do believe there is such a thing in the British psyche as British exceptionalism. And I think it is based, unlike your exceptionalism is not entirely based on your geography. It's based on more of an idea, you know, the city on the shining hill, or the shining city on the hill, whatever it is. Ours, I do think, because of that narrow strip of water between us and the continent, there is no question it has protected us from some of the things, the extremes of politics on the continent, you know, especially in the 20th century, the extremes of fascism and the extremes of communism. So the ideas did not roll across. French Revolution did not roll across to us. And I think that that does have an influence on our collective memory and collective psyche. But, you know, I'm now dealing in something you can't really prove. So to fast forward back to the vote, I'm confident that that little strip of water gives you a psychological idea, almost unthinking and unknowing, that we are separate physically. Now, again, the intellectual class hates that because our intellectual class tends to be, you know, very, very pro-EU. And I might as well put my cards on the table. I voted to remain in the EU. But it doesn't cloud my judgment that many of the people that didn't, a majority, I think will have been somehow affected by this little strip of water that protected us from the Germans and the French and the Spanish long ago in history, before we were all really good friends, but it still has an impact.
You know, as I look through the list of nations, I know we have just a couple of minutes left, but as I look through the list of nations, it makes a lot of sense. There is one outlier that perhaps strikes people as a little off the beaten path, and that is Turkey, which, you know, Turkey's trying to find its own way. In one sense, we get a sense of it wants to reclaim some of the Ottoman glory. But Greece, that is something that was somewhat surprising to me as I began to read about it. Why put Greece in this idea of the power of geography? What's important about Greece's geography today?
Well, there's a number of things. One, it's actually quite a big country in European terms, but so much of it is mountainous that it can't grow a big population because you cannot grow huge amounts of crops on really rocky, craggy mountains. And most of it is rocky, craggy mountains. Very beautiful they are too. And so the amount of land you can use is limited. And so they cling to the shorelines, apart from the mountainous village people. And that means they've always looked out to the sea. They've always been this amazing seafaring nation and indeed shipbuilding nation. And then the geography, if I'm going to do a chapter on Turkey, you have to do a chapter on Greece because they face each other across the Aegean. And then because of the vagaries of history, these small Greek islands, Greek territory, sovereign waters, but so many of them are right next to Turkey. And the international law of the sea gives you 200 miles of your exclusive economic zone. So in one direction, right across the Aegean, it's all Turkish water. In the other, because some of them are, say, a mile from the Turkish coast, they get half a mile each. Hmm. You think Turkey's going to settle for that forever?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And now there's offshore gas discoveries that may be exploited
at some
point.
Yeah.
This could be a very, it could be a powder keg once again, as it has been for millennia. The name of the book is The Power of Geography. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Tim Marshall was a foreign correspondent and diplomatic editor for the United Kingdom's Sky News, and he's the founder and editor of the whatandthewhy.com, a current affairs website. His new book is titled The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.